This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is WBEZ's Weekly News Recap. Happy Friday, Chicago. It's that time in the week where we play a little catch-up on all the news that you need to know. The Bears announced they may be having a change of heart.
Days after demolition began at the former Arlington Park Racecourse, the Bears dropping their own hammer, saying the Arlington Heights property is no longer our singular focus.
Former President Donald Trump made history, but not the good kind.
Breaking news, former President Donald Trump has just been indicted on federal charges after a months-long investigation.
And residents on the southeast side vow to protest relocated, rebranded metal shredder General Iron.
Protesters are vowing to fight a judge's order when it comes to a controversial metal recycling plant on the southeast side.
We should have the equal rights to clean air, clean water, clean land, just like Lincoln Park.
That's a lot, and it's only the tip of the iceberg. So here to help us make sense of the news is Carrie Shepherd, Chicago reporter with Axios, Ramana Hussein, editorial board member and columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times, and Alex Nipkin, reporter with the Illinois Answers Project for the Better Government Association. But let's dive right in. The owners of the Chicago Bears, they're making headlines this week again because they seem to call a timeout on their plans to build a new stadium in Arlington Heights. So give us the play-by-play, Alex.
Listen to all those sports puns.
I mean, shout out to Reset producer Andrea Duffman. But give us the play-by-play of what we've seen over the last few days.
Okay, over the last few days, this has been a pretty long saga going back more than a year since we first learned that the Bears had plans to move their entire operation to Arlington Heights and to build not just a new stadium, but an entire sort of village around it full of new housing and shops and the whole deal.
Yeah.
Basically, what has happened, number one, is that the Bears have gone to Naperville. They talked to Naperville Mayor Scott Wehrli about, is there some kind of possibly deal where the Bears could actually move to Naperville instead of Arlington Heights? Of course, the context behind all this is that for the past couple months, the Bears have been in Springfield trying to negotiate some kind of deal, subsidy, sweetener, whatever you want to call it, in order for basically, their whole thing has been, we're not going to ask for any money for the stadium, but we want to, if we're going to build public infrastructure around the stadium, we want money from government.
Yeah.
That's going to look like tax breaks, could look like a whole bunch of different other things. Arlington Heights said it's open to things like tax increment financing or these other kinds of public-private sort of deals. And they have really been at an impasse. It's not popular with the school districts that need that tax money. Local residents are very skeptical. And so this week we saw the Bears, maybe it's a pump fake, to use another analogy.
another sports analogy.
Or if it's real, going to Naperville, maybe we'll take our business elsewhere. He talked to Brandon Johnson, too.
Yeah.
Johnson has been open about, we want to keep the Bears in Chicago. They released a very vague statement afterwards saying, we talked about how we love the Bears in Chicago, and didn't really say anything more.
Yeah.
But
well,
we don't really
I'm
know what's
glad you,
come from that.
You brought up Johnson because, yeah, he seems to see that this is maybe an opening for Chicago to get back into this stadium game. Let's listen.
I want to make sure that the ownership of the Chicago Bears, the Park District, and the residents of the city of Chicago have a real seat at the table to discuss a pathway forward. So I grew up with the Super Bowl shuffle.
Yes.
We want to make sure that we can keep shuffling here in the city of Chicago with the Bears.
All right. So a couple of questions for the table here. First of all, does anyone think that the Bears are seriously considering any location other than Arlington Heights right now?
I think they're kind of dangling. I mean, I have to tell you, first of all, I'm not an expert on the Bears. I barely
watch football.
But I'm glad Brandon Johnson mentioned the Super Bowl shuffle because I did have the 45 when I was a kid. And I did watch a Super Bowl that year. And I watched it in 2007 when Prince was the headline act
or the halftime act.
Yeah, it was the best one. But I think they're kind of just playing right now. I mean, from what I know, from the little I know, it's kind of like they're dangling it. I mean, I think there are a lot of Chicago sports fans, people who live in Chicago who would like the Bears to stay in Chicago. But then there's also another set of sports fans who feel like the Bears don't want to pay for anything. They want the benefits. And if they want Soldier Field to, like, I guess they would kind of, don't they want to break it down and just build something new because it's too outdated? Mm-hmm. And so the taxpayers would have to pay for that in Chicago. So I don't know, from sports fans or people who I know who like football, there's some people who are like, would love to have the Bears come back. And then there's another half where they feel like the Bears just want to shake everybody down and try to dangle this thing. So I would think that they've already bought the Arlington Racecourse. I think they're just kind of doing this as
this is all talk.
Yeah, I'll talk. That's from what I get, the sense I get from reading all the stories.
Well, you're not alone. I'm curious how you feel, Carrie, that Johnson's negotiating style compares to maybe Lori Lightfoot's.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell. I think that Johnson probably was handed a checklist and, you know, talk to Bears check was on there in the first few weeks because that statement was a real nothing burger. It doesn't seem, you know, which is okay. It's all amorphous right now.
Yeah.
The Bears have the upper hand and they're going to continue to have the upper hand. It's not that uncommon. A lot of major cities have moved stadiums kind of to the exurbs of their cities
right.
And people don't necessarily hate it. But
and the name is still the name, like
name
the big
is still
city
the name.
Name.
Yeah. And but, you know, the Arlington Heights deal, if we back up a little, and Alex is the expert on this, is that they thought that the taxes were going to be one thing. And then they found out, whoa, that has been valued at way higher and the taxes are going to be another thing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, homeowners felt that, too. I will see what happens, but it doesn't seem they're too eager to stay in Chicago.
To your original question, would they actually abandon their plan to move it to Arlington Heights?
Yeah.
I think there are two answers that come to mind for me. One is probably not. It's hard to see why they would, for exactly the reasons that Romana said. They've already put down $197 million on this property. Mm-hmm. That is theirs. They can do whatever they want with it. The other answer is we honestly just don't know, because that's what the difficulty is with these public-private deals or talks about subsidies or tax abatements. Governments have no way of opening up private organizations' books and seeing if they're telling the truth or they're lying, if they say, hey, we need this money, otherwise we're not going to do it.
Right.
The context behind this is that it has been both extremely common over the past 30 years or so for public governments to subsidize new stadiums, and it is also straightforwardly bad fiscal policy. Like, it has been, like, well studied and shown. And so folks are very skeptical of that. That, like I said, the school districts, even legislators, local folks in Arlington Heights. And really the question is, at this point, will they, you know, shop around? Is there a certain point where not even would they would go back to Chicago, but would they go to Memphis or Columbus or St. Louis or someplace that would be much more willing to roll out the red carpet potentially with generous subsidies? Mm. And I think that is what some of these state legislators here in Illinois are worried about, I think, justifiably.
So you think the Bears' strategy maybe could eventually make them the big winners and get them more tax incentives?
Potentially. I think it depends on how hard they're really willing to drive this potential to move to a different city and how much they are willing to drive a hard bargain and really consider the possibility of going to another place that would give them bigger subsidies. Or if they would just not want to deal with all that headache.
Yeah. And Romana, back to Mayor Johnson, he was elected on the promise of helping underinvested communities, right?
Yep.
Is there any way that he can, you know, come out a winner if he makes concessions to a big, wealthy corporation like the Bears?
I think he would in some. I think a lot of people would look at him and think, okay, so he got the Bears back to Chicago. I think for a lot of people and as sports fans, this is, we have to remember, this is a very sports heavy city. People love their Bears. I mean, there's been skits on SNL about Bears fans. And so, I mean, this is just something that we're known for. And, you know, a lot of people do feel like Chicago Bears going to Arlington Heights. Like, that's such a far, you know, way to go. So I think if he did do something and got the Bears to come and, you know, still invested in these underserved communities, I mean, I think he would still be held accountable for doing that. But
yeah,
I think if he got the Bears back, I think he definitely would be a winner in a lot of people's eyes.
This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and we are going behind the headlines in the weekly news recap with Alex Nitkin of the Illinois Answers Project for the Better Government Association, Carrie Shepard of Axios, and Ramana Hussein of the Chicago Sun-Times. A reminder, you can now watch our weekly news recap live. We're on WBEZ's Facebook and YouTube pages. We're also on Reset's Facebook page. If you're on YouTube, leave us a comment or question in that chat box, and we will try to get to your comments and questions on the air. Carrie, help me take a step away from football, will you? I want to focus on another game in town, politics.
Yeah.
So there's talk again at City Council about banning aldermen from holding second jobs. What are the details there?
Yeah, and Alex was just telling me before that far fewer have second jobs than they used to, you know, most notoriously.
Not as many side hustles these days.
Not as many side hustles. Most notoriously, you may, you know of Alderman Burke, who is accused of using his powerful position in the Finance Committee. He had a side gig as a real estate tax attorney. I think it can only be good for transparency and ethical reform, which we hear about promised all the time. In fact, this council said they want the same thing. They want reform because it takes away the opportunity and any conflict, any chance of conflict of interest. Hey, look, I'm making money off of, this business, so I'm going to push through the permit. You know, there is the other side of it of someone like Tom Tunney, who is no longer in office, but a longtime alderman on the north side in Lakeview. You know, he would say, like, look, he owned Ann Sather Restaurant, is a well-known breakfast chain, you know, cinnamon rolls, and saying like, oh, but I was a good advocate for small business owners, and people in my constituents would say, hey, look, this is, you know what it's like to be a small business ower.
They're citizen legislators.
They're supposed to be
advocating for themselves.
But I think that I think most people would agree if we want a independent council and we want that this is a good idea to strip away those conflicts, possible conflicts.
Does anyone here feel that this proposal is going anywhere?
I think it's hard to say right now. There was a great article in the Tribune that A.D. Quigg wrote, really looking at the details of what this would actually take. And it's one of these things that on its face seems like a great idea. But even I think the real question here is, how do you define job? Because there are a lot of really tricky issues of outside income that older people have right now. I mean,
rental properties.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, in that case,
right.
Alderman Walter Burnett is a landlord. He owns 8 properties, I think, outside of his own home. And he very transparently was like, how can you just take this away? You can't just like some people like inherited money from their parents. I mean, Alderman Bill Conway is very well known to be like the son of a billionaire and has all kinds of different investments and interests there. And so how do you thread that? And that is exactly what Chair Alderman Matt Martin, who's the new chair of the City Council Ethics Committee, said when he was asked about the prospects for this kind of ordinance. Like, yes, it's an interesting idea. We're going to have a lot more of these kinds of difficult conversations about what that private source of income is that needs to be banned and how we would even do that.
And a reminder, aldermanic salaries, they range from $115,000 to around a little over $142,000, right? Should that be enough to be considered a full-time job, Ramana?
I think that's enough to be considered a full-time job. I'm a reporter here. And, you know,
from a journalist?
Yes, from a journalist.
That's enough.
Relating to journalists, the alderwoman from the 48th Ward, the new alderwoman for the 48th Ward, she was working at the Chicago Reader. And she gave up that job. And, you know, I'm sure she wasn't making the big bucks at the Chicago Reader, and she left. And so I think these are good questions. And I think there needs to be, like, you know, obviously it needs to be detailed about what income is OK and what isn't. But I think it would take out a lot of the, you know, it would make the government more transparent. And I know a lot of the city council members who are against this proposal are saying that, you know, with their jobs, they've been better informed by having another job in decisions that are being made. And I was thinking, well, maybe just being a full-time city council member, it's a lot. And so just juggling all these things. And yeah, I think it's good, you know, if you have property, I think that's different than if you're actually working for a law firm or working for a special interest group or lobbying. So I think it's something that they're going to be discussed. Will it happen or not? I don't know. But yeah. I think 115,000 to 142,000. I would be happy with
it. Could have been a lot lower.
I would have been happy with 115,000 myself. But you know, some of the city
council, for yourself, yes,
some of the city council members I know haven't taken raises. So you know, I'm just saying, like you take the example of the alderwoman from the 48th ward. She gave up a job. I mean, it's
and a small business.
Yeah, a small business. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's not like, you know, she's rolling in the dough. So it's like, why can't the city council members who are making a lot of money, you take the example of Alderman Burke, it's like there is a question I think a lot of people had and questions a lot of people had.
Well, I'm going to stick with you for another moment here, Ramona, because another story here, CPS employees, they got a new perk this week that I want to hear about. Update us on this new parental leave policy.
So the parental leave policy for people who work for the city of Chicago is 12 weeks. And the teachers, people who were part of the teachers union had 6 weeks. And most teachers did not take advantage of this policy. What they would do is usually take their sick leave. And that was about 3 months. And so in January, Lori Lightfoot and the CTU started negotiating whether or not they should have this 12-week you know, paid leave for parental leave, I should say. And this applies to any parent of any gender. This includes a situation if someone's fostering a child or adopting, which is great. I think a lot of people would think that, okay, 12 weeks makes sense. But I think the question here is that, you know, this was something that was being negotiated. And Brandon Johnson was a paid organizer, I believe, for the CTU. I just want to make sure I'm using the right correct term, organizer. And so, you know, before the elections, that was one of the concerns a lot of people had. Now, will Brandon Johnson just rubber stamp everything the CTU, you know, proposes or wants? And I think there's going to be a lot of questions about, you know, is and I don't think anybody disagrees that any parent should get the 12 weeks.
But it is.
But a lot of people are thinking like, okay, so most people in the city don't get the 3 months. They get, well, the 12 weeks, they already get the 3 months. So they're like, okay, is this giving them more? Mm. And I think that people will just question, you know, the way it was done, the way it was handled.
Yeah.
Will this be something that Brandon Johnson's going to do time and time again with the CTU? So I think that's what the question is and what a lot of people will be kind of talking about in the next few weeks, probably.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, folks. I mean, we're pretty used to seeing Chicago Public Schools, the Chicago Teachers Union, and the mayor at odds with one another.
I don't think it's a good thing.
Is this a new era?
That's another way of looking at the really tight alliance that the mayor now has with CTU. It's, yes, just like Ramona was saying, there is potentially, you know, a question of whose interests he's representing, but also a lot of people will look at this very rare new image of CTU President Stacey Davis Gates and CPS CEO Pedro Martinez up there together announcing something in tandem and say, hey, that's really refreshing. They're actually working on something.
Yeah. Nobody wins when there's so much acrimony between the city and the union. And most definitely the people who lose the most are the students and the parents and the teachers. I think to your point of like, is this how Brandon Johnson's going to work with CTU? I mean, I think we should take it by a policy by policy basis. I mean, it's hard to disagree that 3 months, which is far less than most of the world gets, you know, for parents to be home. And also Pedro Martinez said, like a lot of teachers, a lot of women especially end up leaving teaching because they can't make it work with their families. A lot of teachers I know, they and this isn't always possible, they try to plan to have their children in the summer. So at least they have 3 months and then maybe, you know, sick leave or whatever.
Right.
So
that's a good point.
I thought it was really, to Alex's point, great to see our leadership together and not fighting and making it about what they can do.
It's kind of refreshing.
That's good.
I gotta admit.
For the teachers, right?
Yeah. And like you said, Carrie, I think 80% of the CTU are women.
Are women, right.
So, you know, this is a union that's a lot of women, so it does affect them. So I'm just saying that I think people are just going to, it's just going to be something
for
people to pick on Brandon Johnson for.
Definitely a conversation starter. Back now with more Reset. A judge overruled former Mayor Lightfoot's denial of a permit to General Iron, which has been renamed Southside Recycling. Now, after months of protest, she eventually blocked the company from relocating its Lincoln Park facility to the southeast side. So, Carrie, why did this judge end up overruling the city? And why now?
I think the judge is saying that it didn't follow the rules of what they should be allowed to do as a business. He's not maybe taking into consideration the larger issue, which is at play here, which we hear a lot about. And that is that people on the southeast side traditionally have their environmental problems. The air is different there. There was reporting in the Tribune this week. Temperatures are different across our city, you know, based on where you live. This is common in the southeast side. This is where, you know, the steel mills were. Mm-hmm. And this is what they're saying. I mean, you know, when General Iron set up in Lincoln Park, it wasn't the Lincoln Park it is today. Believe it or not, Lincoln Park wasn't always mm-hmm. the beautiful, you know, super expensive housing stock that it is now. But they're saying, like, look, this is a classic. This happens in Chicago all the time. Make sure everything's okay in this neighborhood, which is usually a white neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But don't worry about the effects it's going to have on a black and brown neighborhood. And Southeast Side is largely Latino. You know, Brandon Johnson says, which is not unexpected, that he's going to appeal the judge's ruling. So this has been like a tug of war that I know, Romano, your colleague, Brett Chase, mm-hmm. it sometimes is just followed vigilantly. And it's just back and forth. But it does highlight that, you know, these residents on the southeast side, they have activated and organized and said, like, enough is enough. Yeah. Like, we want to say we deserve. There's so many studies that say some of these neighborhoods, asthma rates are higher for kids. So, you know,
it's dangerous.
It's dangerous, and it shouldn't be dangerous to breathe the air where you live.
Absolutely. I want to head over now to Springfield, Romana, where AM radio has become a topic of conversation. What's going on?
So, I mean, I don't know how many people in this room actually listen to AM radio.
Hey.
One.
I remember what it is.
I was going to say you're probably really young. Yeah. So not that you think that not that many people listen to AM radio, but one of my colleagues, David Roeder, wrote about how Chicago is a really huge market for AM radio. 48% of Chicagoans who use radio actually listen to AM radio. Now, what's happening is that new car manufacturers who make electric cars, the newer electric cars, they have, when you put AM radio in there, a lot of the manufacturers are saying that the AM radio frequency kind of messes around with the motor, interferes with the motor. So Tesla has already gotten rid of AM radio in its electric cars, which I think all of them are electric cars.
Right.
And then Ford did get rid of AM radio, but then they reversed their decision. BMW, Mazda, Volkswagen, and Volvo, they're kind of heading towards that way of, you know, getting rid of AM radio. Now, you know, a lot of people argue, people who work for, you know, the people who represent the radio industry will say, well, why get rid of these choices, programming? Not everybody has like satellite radio.
Right.
This is like taking away the opportunities. And in places like Chicago, you know, they have foreign language programming here. So for our mm-hmm. diverse community, people say, like, why are you getting rid of these programming?
But yeah, as you pointed out before, AM radio has got a big audience.
It does. It does. And so this week, the House Energy Committee, there's a subcommittee in D.C., had a hearing on whether or not AM radio is needed in cars. Now, their concern mostly centers on safety. So a lot of people will be asking, like, what does this have to do with safety?
Right.
So AM radio, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Operations and in D.C., they have a lot of their frequencies or a lot of their stations are tied to our national emergency system. So when there is an emergency, AM radio works the best.
How will we know?
And AM frequency is stronger than FM frequency. And so, you know, a lot of car manufacturers are saying, like, this isn't, you know, nobody listens to AM radio anymore. And they can hear about, you know, emergencies on their phone because we all get alerts on our smartphones.
Right.
But if there is an emergency, a lot of people are arguing with weather, your cell phone can stop working. There's no cell connection. And since AM radio, like, and especially in rural America, mm-hmm. if you're driving, AM works the strongest.
It does.
So,
yeah.
So there's a question about safety right now. So, you know, people on both leaders on both sides of the political aisle are saying that they want to implement an act that, you know, enforces car manufacturers to keep AM and radio. So that's a discussion that's going on right now. And that happened earlier this week. Yeah. So I think for a lot of people, less than programming, it's a concern about safety and people just want to make sure they can reach out. I think one of the gentleman who's representing the car manufacturers was saying that, you know, maybe it's time. And I think this is a good point. Maybe it's time the federal government needs to update its system and make sure it goes on to, you know, can be heard, you know, through different frequencies. And that's a good point, too, because I think during the Cold War, there was something on AM. There was two AM radio stations. I was doing this while I was doing my research on the editorial story that I did this week. There was like two AM radio stations that could be used for emergencies during the Cold War, and it could also interfere with, if any enemies were trying to, like, use radio to send signals. And so, like, that's outdated. So, yeah. You know, maybe the system we have now is a little outdated and we have to update it. And I think there needs to be, I don't think people should rush to get rid of AM radio right now, right away, especially if there's a question of safety. I think that's the most important pressing issue.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting
to see.
There's
an argument
on
both sides.
Yeah, for sure.
For sure.
I mean, weather and traffic at the eights. Yeah. I mean, seriously, yeah. I started in radio more than 15 years ago, and radio's always been they've always threatened radio's going to die, and radio's not going to die.
Right. No, it isn't.
When you pass people on the Kennedy, that's what they're listening to a lot of times.
Yeah.
You tune into that, and, you know, that's what talk radio is. And to your point, in rural areas, there's often, I'm sure you see when you're on the highway, you see a little blue sign that says tune your radio to something, something AM to get, you know, the latest information.
Traffic information, for sure. Let's pivot to a story you've been working on, Alex. This one has to do with coach houses.
Yes, coach houses are, you may have seen them, these little baby houses that are behind the main houses on a lot.
Some of those baby houses are very expensive.
Sometimes they're called, like, granny flats, because the idea is that sometimes people can age out of their house and move into a little house behind it. They have been illegal to build in the city of Chicago since 1957, at a time when city leaders were very worried about overpopulation and overcrowding. Now, suffice it to say, you know, we have the opposite concern. We want to draw more people to live in the city and to do so affordably. So
can this be seen as a way to create more affordable housing?
That's certainly the goal. That's the idea behind it. This efforts to legalize coach houses, and also the sort of umbrella term here is additional dwelling unit or accessory dwelling unit, EDUs is how you'll hear them described. And over the past decade or so, there's been a real effort, especially in more expensive cities and coastal cities, to allow the proliferation of more, not just coach houses, but in more cases,
tiny houses.
Potentially tiny houses. I was going to say most of them are basement unit, like existing basement or attic spaces that to this point have not been legal to just turn into units. And so this is a relatively affordable option. It's not necessarily affordable to create one of these out of nothing. That's, you know, one of the issues. But it's an increasingly popular tool to create what sometimes is described as gentle density, especially as we see so many naturally occurring, you know, two flats and three flats being demolished or gutted, that this has really become a popular way to introduce that natural affordability back into the city's housing fabric. And so in 2020, the city's housing department under Lori Lightfoot's administration came forward with a proposal to legalize this all across the city. And who did not like that is a lot of members of the city council, aldermen, who said, well, wait a minute, when someone wants to build in my ward, they got to ask for a zoning change and ask my permission because I, the alderman, am the voice of the people. And if they don't, you know, if they don't get my permission, then they can't do it.
And they say it exactly like that.
I mean,
because I, the alderman, am the voice of the people.
You know what? Not that far off in some cases. So, to be fair, they are elected and they really see their responsibility as to, you know, represent the voice of their neighbors in the city council.
Right.
It turns out that ADUs were legalized in Chicago in 2021 through a pilot zone program that was, if we're honest, was done based on political decisions and not policy decisions, mm-hmm. which aldermen were okay with having ADUs in their own wards. Yeah. And so 2 years later, we have seen some success. The housing department likes the program. The new chair of the zoning committee, Carlos Ramirez Rosa, he's an ally of Mayor Brandon Johnson and was an early advocate for this. And he, too, wants to work to expand it. But as I wrote this week, he is really sounding a note of caution of, like, there are still a lot of logistical hurdles. Mm-hmm. We want to put city funding behind this to help people actually afford to build these. And also, there is still a lot of political resistance still in the city council. And so he said, yes, the mayor wants to expand it. I want to expand it. But hold your horses. It's probably going to be at least a couple months before
hold your horses.
Also, who's watching to make sure these are actually affordable? As someone who's on, like, a perpetual housing search and, like, you see coach houses all the time that sell for, like, $1 million because they've been revamped. And to Alex's point, like, a lot of neighborhoods are losing their 2 and 3 flats because they're becoming single-family homes.
Mm-hmm. Affordable is such a relative term.
It's such a relative term. And I think I thought your story was great, Alex, and fascinating. But I guess it is the idea of, like, so often we get this sell of, like, affordable housing. Mm-hmm. But, like, who's actually maintaining, that affordability and affordability for everyone, right?
Sorry to interrupt. This was a huge part of the conversation, from the left in the city council when these were being introduced. How are we going to make sure that these are actually affordable? And so one of the provisions that was baked into the existing ordinance is that for any landlord who is going to build 2 or more basement or attic units, and a lot of these, think of, like, Rogers Park, a big courtyard building with a bunch of, like, laundry rooms, are adding, potentially 5 or 10 or 15 new units. Half of those new basement or attic units have to be affordable at, I think it was something like 60% AMI. Mm. So that was the way that was built in. Again, it's sort of been ticky-tack here and there, not really big enough to make much of an impact, but that's why they want to expand it.
Well, let's keep it moving here. Ramana, community activists were marching on the city's south side asking that more resources be put into investigating missing Black women. Tell us a bit more.
Yeah, so there was a march on Wednesday, I believe, in Bronzeville for missing and murdered Black and brown women. It's called the We Watch for Her We Walk for Her March.
Yeah.
I think this is definitely something that a lot of people think about. We always talk about when there's a missing woman, it's usually a white woman. And I think of back on all the stories that I hear about when it comes to missing and murdered women, they tend to be white. And I think it's only recently that we started looking at cases of missing Black and brown women get a little more attention than they used to, but they don't get enough attention as they do if the victims are white. And one of the things, I used to cover the criminal courthouse for a couple years, and there was a case involving this man named Andre Crawford, and he basically murdered 11 women between 1993 and 1999. These were sex workers, and he killed them, enticing them basically for drugs and then he ended up killing 11 women. And I remember covering this case, and I had never heard of him. I had never heard of these women being killed. I shouldn't say him, but I never heard of these women being killed. And I remember thinking the whole time while I was covering this case, I'm like, if it was 11 women suddenly missing on parts of the north side, I think there would have been more of a conversation. There could be a question on, like, is it because there were sex workers? They weren't, valued as much. But I think if there were white women who were sex workers, I think it would have been a bigger story. So this is something I think a lot of people talk about, at least anecdotally. And I think it's a good question. And a lot of cases don't get solved. A lot of cases don't get solved. But the question is, how much attention is paid to, women of color who are missing or murdered? So I think it's a question. And I think it's great that people are bringing attention to this, because this is a conversation we've been having for years.
Yeah. The fact that this is the sixth year is a bad thing. The sixth year for this march. And could there be, my colleague Monica Eng mentioned something. She thinks in Detroit, they have a department in the police department that focuses on this. Mm-hmm. And, like, that's a question for CPD, to Ramana's point, like, you rarely would see those on the ticker in the newsroom on the TV. Like, there was a story years ago of a young woman. I think she was out in Rosemont. I mean, but the fact that who's paying attention and how can we pay more attention and change that?
All right. I got to squeeze in some national political issues because there are plenty. But, the Republican presidential race is heating up. We've got news of former President Trump's historic, stunning, whatever word you want to throw on there, indictment coming on the heels of several candidates entering the race, including one local candidate, right? I'm talking about Mike Pence. Any thoughts, brief thoughts on his candidacy and maybe how Trump's indictment could impact the race?
I think that we're going to continue to see if all of the other candidates' strategy of never attacking Trump and never, you know, and rushing to his defense in terms of the indictment, maybe that'll be the thing that helps take him down in the first. I mean, I'm kidding because I just don't see how anything changes that dynamic, you know?
Yeah. No, no. And even Pence, like, he was sitting, you know, when he announced his candidacy earlier this week, he was talking about Trump and criticizing him. But then a few minutes later, I think he was on Fox News and he said that he would support whatever Republican presidential candidate, if it's not him, he'll support them. So that theoretically could be Trump. So he's kind of talking on both sides of his mouth. So I don't know if people will take Pence that seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like on one hand, you know, when he was with Trump and, you know, vice president, he didn't say much, but he talked, he kind of criticized him a little too late. So I don't know if that, so too many people, I don't know if too many people in his party are going to be supporting him.
We also got word from the White House. President Biden's going to be coming to town on June 28th. This is a fundraiser hosted by Pritzker, right, Alex?
Yeah, this is all about the money, which has been something that we've seen. You know, unfortunately, this is the thing that we often see attract national political figures to Chicago because we're, you know, not a swing state like our neighbors in Iowa. So he is, yeah, the president is coming to Chicago. What we don't know is whether there is going to be any kind of, you know, public event, rally, reelection campaign, anything like that. But it is just another testament to the real power of our governor's pockets. You know, I mean, it was a huge factor, we know, in the DNC's selection of Chicago to be the host of the 2024 Democratic National Convention.
Yeah.
We don't know whether there's going to be a public event. I'm curious about, you know, sometimes the question is, are there going to be protesters outside or a thing like that or supporters? I'll be watching to see, will there be a tarmac moment where the mayor comes out to greet him? There was some drama last time about how the previous mayor, Lori Lightfoot, was not in town for that. So we're going to have some maybe lip readers coming out and seeing what kinds of, secret information they exchange on the tarmac. But, yep, just a
and
fundraiser.
Let us not forget that Pritzker, there were rumors and talk of Pritzker actually maybe considering a run at some point for president. So we'll see how that pans out.
Back now with more of the top stories. We've had some weird weather this week. Northwest Indiana is under an air quality alert today, while air pollution in Chicago was at unhealthy levels for people in sensitive groups. That includes older adults, children, and folks with asthma. Those Canadian wildfires also impacted the White Sox. The team's Wednesday game against the Yankees in New York got canceled. Did any of you experience air quality issues? I mean, I think I felt a little bit of burning in my eyes.
I mean,
everything
in my life this season is allergies. So I'm so consumed with like just that I didn't. But seeing the photos from my colleagues on the East Coast was wow. That was
bizarre.
It's so bizarre and scary.
Yeah.
And but no, when you said we had some weird weather, I was like, what? The weather was beautiful this week.
I don't know who you are. Other people.
Of course.
Carrie,
of course.
We got to think of others, okay? Now, my cousin in New York sent me some video of her walking from, she works at a courthouse in Manhattan, commuting home to Brooklyn, and it was literally orange. I couldn't believe
it. It was like an Instagram filter.
Yeah. Oh, no, friend of mine who used to work for the Sun-Times, a former colleague, she had a picture on Instagram and she said that she has some sort of like breathing thing for her cats and for them inside the house. And so it looked pretty bad. I mean, I thought in Chicago, I live right by the lake in Rogers Park, and I kept looking out the window to see if it looked a little different, and it didn't. And I didn't, every time I've gone out for my walks, when I take a break for work, I didn't feel like it was a little worse than usual.
Yeah.
At least I don't feel like, I mean, I know they said that there probably was, like, for people who have asthma and people who are older, they probably could have sensed it, but yeah. I didn't sense anything personally.
Also, I was looking for the orange moon. Remember we had one of those?
Yeah. Also, you lost me at the fact that you get to take walks in the middle of the workday.
Well, I kind of do that or else I'm going to go mad.
If I could just do a walking studio, that would be great.
Let's take this show on the road.
Let's go. I'm on a bus tomorrow. Why don't I walk today? All right. One weather-related issue most of us have been noticing over the last few weeks as well, Alex, is this white fluff.
Yeah. More unfortunate news for people who have allergies. These are cottonwood trees that have been releasing their seeds. This is a pretty common June phenomenon in the city of Chicago and in a lot of parts of the country. What's not common is just the sheer quantity of fluff of these seeds that we have been seeing.
But I want to tell you, we did talk to an allergist earlier this week on the program, and it's not a problem for allergies. Mm. It actually is not contributing to allergies at all. So
interesting.
Yeah, have no fear. Okay. Just clean it up and carry on.
Someone should tell that to
the trees
my nose.
Are just reproductive.
Yeah, me too. In my eyes.
Yeah. But it is because, as I understand it, what ecologists are telling us, they're calling it a mass seeding event. Because it is the conditions this past spring have been unusually warm and especially unusually dry.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of places around the city where people have been sending pictures of, like, it honestly looks like it snowed. Mm-hmm. There is so much fluff on the ground. There are all of these fluffy cottonwood seeds. They are very pretty and, fun fact, very flammable. So word to the wise, if anyone is doing any kinds of, like, backyard bonfires or barbecues or anything like that, just be careful. They can potentially be part of a fire risk.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, they're flammable.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Dangerous fluff.
Yeah.
But let's talk about some positive travel news, shall we? The city's tourism bureau says local hotels actually set a record last weekend for the highest occupancy rates ever in Chicago. You're smiling, Carrie, because you know that we owe our thanks to Taylor Swift.
I mean,
perhaps.
Swifties.
Swifties everywhere.
Swifties were
felt like
everywhere.
I was the only person
who
not
wasn't going
at
to the
Taylor
concert.
Swift concert. Yeah, and just like, so that does not surprise me. But also the James Beard Awards. I think there was another conference.
Yeah, an average of 44,000 rooms were filled last Friday and Saturday for that ceremony. So, I mean, did anybody...
Prices were high, but...
Anybody venture downtown last weekend?
No, I didn't.
I stayed away.
I went out of town.
You just
practice for NASCAR. Yeah.
My younger sister was downtown last week, and she's like, God, I hope nobody thinks I'm a Swiftie. You know what I mean? But the thing is, Swifties, yay, you know, but I think it's just like, I think there's tourism figures that came out. They said that tourism is, you know, is 60% of more tourists than we had in 2021 and 2022. And one tourism group says that could number could get higher this year. So I think there's just a lot of event. And hey, we're Chicago. We do have, you know, a lot of people sit there and tell us how bad Chicago is and nobody wants to visit. And we definitely have our problems.
Yeah.
You know, there's definitely concerns that we have here. But hey, we have a lot of cultural attractions here. And I think people do want to come
people
and check it out.
People are coming to town. People are coming to town. Well, we mentioned the James Beard Awards. I want you to quickly, Ramona, tell us about some winners here, because three Chicago chefs took home what's essentially this Oscars in the culinary world, right? Who are they?
Yeah, so Damar Brown, he got the Emerging Chef Award from Virtue Restaurant, and the two chef owners at the Filipino restaurant called Kasama in
Ukrainian Village.
Nice.
Tim Flores, I believe, and Jeannie Kwan. So that's really cool. And, you know, we're just talking about tourism. I think we're also known as, a big restaurant cities. A lot of the food we have here is great. So I think that's great. You know, I always pay attention to the James Beard Awards. I mean, not that it matters, but sometimes I'm like, oh, maybe I should try one of these restaurants. And I know both of these restaurants. I haven't been to either, but I've been wanting to go to both.
I mean, those names come up on the show all the time.
I was on the red carpet on Monday covering it, and their outfits were amazing, number one. But yeah, it is, like, to Ramona's point, like, how many chefs from New York, everywhere, Portland, all these places are like, it's Chicago.
Exactly.
This is the foodie capital, you know?
Well, speaking of culinary icons, I want you to briefly tell us, Carrie, about one that's heading to the Smithsonian.
Yes. So the Ebony Test Kitchen is going to the National Museum of African American History and Culture.
Amazing.
So, you know, as I'm sure everyone knows, the legacy of Ebony and Jet, as I've reported on Johnson Publishing throughout the years, every person would tell me, like, oh my gosh, every black home had Ebony or Jet on the coffee table. So the
I can confirm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the iconic building on Michigan, the Ebony Jet building, Columbia College bought that in like 2010. And there was this fear of like, oh no, what is going to happen to this? Because it's this super 70s, like bright colored kitchen. I mean, you have to go look up the pictures.
But also like extremely beige somehow at the same time. It's just like, very cool.
And Lee Bay is just a huge advocate for it. But this is where for the magazine, they would test these recipes. And Landmarks Illinois dismantled the kitchen and bought it so it would be saved. And now it's going to be in the Smithsonian, which I think is incredible.
I think that's
because
great.
Johnson Publishing, so important, not just Chicago, but to the country.
Yeah. For sure. All right. Efforts to turn the former Southside home of blues legend Muddy Waters into a museum. They're one step closer to reality. The Mellon Foundation gave the project its biggest donation to date, which is $1.1 million. So I just wanted to throw that in there. Best of luck to them with that. Also, Muddy Waters' old home, shameless plug. It's one of many stops that we're going to be making tomorrow. That's when Reset is actually going on the road for a blues history bus tour throughout Bronzeville. I cannot wait for that. I'm going to be on the
That's
bus
awesome.
With Dennis Rodkin, who's our architecture sleuth, and Sherman Dilla Thomas tomorrow afternoon. Some of you are going to be on the bus. If you are registered for the sold-out tour, I'll see you then. If not, I'll catch you next time. It's also going to coincide with Chicago Blues Festival. So it's just all around a fantastic experience that's going to be had. Anybody blues fans at the table?
I mean, fan of the Blues Fest. And so, what you're doing sounds awesome. Yeah. I thought you were saying some of us were going to be on. I was like,
no,
great.
Excited. Some of you. No, I'm talking to my people,
YouTubers,
my Facebookers, my listeners. Yeah, so we're going to do that, and that's going to be super fun. But we've had lots of fun with you folks today. We'll have to wrap it here. And give our thanks to Carrie Shepherd of Axios, Ramana Hussein of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Alex Nitkin of the Better Government Association. Thank you, all. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You too.
Thank you.
This episode of Reset was produced by Andrea Guffman, and it was edited by Andrew Merriweather and Linnea Dominic. Get the recap and all the great coverage that we do here on Reset by subscribing to our podcast. And when you do, be sure to leave us a rating and review. That'll do it for Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a great weekend.